weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I. Each week, this podcast will bring together some of the world's experts on weather and climate to explain the science behind what's happening. And we want to hear from you. If you have a weather or climate question you want answered, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. As promised, our second segment is about climate. I'm now joined by Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford. Welcome, Trent.
Yeah, thanks, Maddie.
Of course. So, Trent, what is a state climatologist?
Yeah. So on a meta level, I kind of ask myself that a lot. Right? What is a state climatologist? More practically, every state in the union except Massachusetts and Arkansas has a state climatologist. We all do similar things. Essentially, the state climatologist acts as the state's point person on climate, in some cases, weather issues. So from my perspective, I'm a climate researcher. I do work in drought, extreme heat, climate extremes, climate change impacts more specifically. But I also do a lot of public outreach and engagement. So going to different parts of the state, talking about issues that we're seeing with climate and weather, in some cases, climate change impacts, giving updates on what's going on with our climate and weather.
I also want to loop into the conversation Dr. Anna Barros. She is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering here at the University of Illinois and also serves as the director for the Center for Secure Water. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
For those who are just learning of the Secure Water Center, can you tell listeners what your focus is on?
So at the Center for Secure Water, we're interested in all aspects of water security, from protection, planning, and preparedness for extreme events, to public health, to design and implementation of water infrastructure, water supply, and actually water allocation, water management overall, and really being prepared to address all problems at the nexus of water and energy, water and food, water and transportation, et cetera, et cetera.
So there has been a lot of discussion about the risk communication around the Texas July 4th flooding event. From your perspective, what could have been better about the communication?
So I think the issue with risk communication, it's really a longstanding issue that has been going on for decades. And it all stems from the difficulty in making very good forecasts of precipitation in complex orography or topography. And because of that, there has been always this difficulty in having long lead time information. So a flash flood has a time scale between 0 and 6 hours. So that means that effectively, when you make a warning 12 hours ahead, you really only have 6 hours to respond. The other problem with these forecasts is that it's very hard to pinpoint exactly where the flash flood might happen using our current methods and models. And so we know that over a general area, there might be a flash flood, but it's really difficult right now using our standard traditional models to know exactly where it's going to occur. So as a result of that, there's a lot of conservative posture in terms of issuing warnings, because if you issue too many warnings, the public will get fatigue of flash flood warnings, right? That never happened until they do.
So far about when it comes to risk communication, we talk about the warning, the forecast stage, kind of the emergency management stage, but breaking it out to maybe a longer term, the planning stage, something you talked to with the Water Security Center. With this Texas event, we had a handful of camps with dozens of kids in mapped flood zones. This wasn't an area that we felt, well, that never floods here. So, I mean, on the long-term risk planning side, can you speak to some of the efforts and challenges to communicate the risk of flood zones and floodplains and why we still see development in those places?
And explain how hydrology works,
yeah,
river hydraulics,
yeah,
right? It's funny because everybody sees the rain, and so we all feel that it's familiar. It's kind of a known quantity, so to speak, but it's not really when you have these extreme events. But the other side of things is to really discuss, right, what can you do? You can still use the floodplain, but if you receive a warning like this, and if it's a long lead warning, then you should really act in some way. And what is the way? We should have specific instructions. So we are actually working with IBM and the National Park Service in developing a flood view, we call it flood view app, that will actually provide park rangers with localized information, where they are, what the risk is. And so you can basically get information around you, situational awareness, and then move out of the way. Because really the only solution for flash floods is to get out of the way, right? And so you need to actually have it mapped in a very clear way. In the same way that we get into an airplane and there's a stewardess who will open a little, you know, a booklet and will say, well, these are the exit doors and, you know, you should follow the lights and just do it this way. We should have exactly the same sort of information for these kinds of events. And so if the camps are in the floodplain, and a lot of the time, you know, it will be wonderful weather, the kids will have such a wonderful time. But if you know 24 hours or even 48 hours in advance that this could happen, then you don't risk at all, right? You just move out and you have alternative plans. You have a rain check plan for what you would do in a day like this. And we have to really have this conversation and make sure that's adopted and taken seriously again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that app would be a great idea because especially if you're not from the area, you can just pull it up and see kind of what's my risk here.
Yeah, and you see, for example, in areas that are relatively flat, I don't think Illinois is that flat. After you live here, you realize it's not that flat, but everybody thinks it's very flat. But so even in flat areas, right, this is also a problem because, you know, you could be in your car driving and suddenly you get a flash flood warning. What do you do? It's a flat area. Where should you go? What's the plan, right? So it's really important wherever you are to have this situational awareness information.
Absolutely, yeah. Just want to take a quick moment to say that this is Weather Realness, the show about weather and climate here in Illinois. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, and we are talking about flooding with Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford and Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois, Anna Barros.
Some officials in Vermont are calling this week's deluge a thousand-year flood.
Last year was a once-in-500-year flood event.
We are at a thousand-year level.
So-called 500-year rainfall.
A 100 years flood.
Even though extreme precipitation events that cause flash flooding along rivers are more frequent and severe, many places are not prepared to handle the water. Here is an excerpt of a report by Rebecca Hersher of NPR's Climate Desk.
I think it's highly confusing to people. It's based on probabilities.
Alice Hill studies disaster resilience.
Many people assume that if their area has experienced the 1 in 100-year flood, that means that for the next 99 years, they need not worry about flooding. So,
and that's not the case?
That's not the case.
So here's what a 100-year flood does mean. It means there's a 1% chance it will happen each year. If it happens this year, there's still a 1% chance it will happen next year.
As with the flip of a coin, if you flip heads twice in a row, that doesn't mean that you're going to get tails the next time. So you could have three very significant floods right in a row.
Back here at Weather Realness, we know this is a pretty complex issue, but as the state climatologist, Trent Ford, how is extreme precipitation changing with climate change?
Yeah, so pretty much in almost every global region, what we're seeing is precipitation changes as a response to climate change. Just giving Illinois as an example, Illinois is getting wetter. The mean kind of total annual precipitation, how much rain we get in a given year, has increased about 10% over the last 100 years or so, give or take. Extreme precipitation is increasing at a far faster rate. So the last National Climate Assessment that was published back in 2023 estimated that the top 1% of all precipitation events, the very extreme of the extreme, have increased by 45%. So the mean is shifting by 10%, but the extreme is shifting four times that. So that means that our whole characteristics of rainfall are changing such that we're getting more of these really intense rainfall events. And even in places like the desert Southwest that are experiencing a drying trend or have experienced a aridification trend, a drying trend over the last 100 years, they're still seeing their extreme precipitation increase. It's kind of an interesting pattern. So that's kind of the historical. When we look at climate models, there's still some uncertainty with precipitation projections, but most models project a continuation of that increase in the very intense, heavy precipitation, which has some ramifications for how we're planning for flash flooding and things like that.
Absolutely. That's interesting that you see that same trend in dry places mm-hmm. versus wetter places like here in Illinois. So just want to take a second to say that you're listening to Weather Realness, a show about weather and climate here in Illinois. And today we are joined by Anna Barros, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois and state climatologist Trent Ford, talking about the July 4th flash flooding event in Kerrville, Texas, and flooding in Illinois. So, Anna, let's switch gears to flooding here in Illinois. We typically don't see floods like we saw in the hill country of Texas. What kind of flooding are we prone to in Illinois?
So, you know, this is a really interesting because we have two different types of floods, and I think, and I hope that Trent will correct me and jump in as needed. So some are at very small scale, right? And they are associated with small scale systems that can be very intense. And so you have a very localized response. Because Illinois is in the central part of the country, and so we're sort of on the way of the storm track, we also get, you know, sometimes the impacts of very large scale, changes in weather. For example, we will, if we have an El Nino or La Nina event, for example, going on in the Pacific, that impacts the types of floods we get here as well, because it also impacts whether the weather is actually warmer or colder. So whether you have more snow or less snow, whether when the spring comes, you have rain on snow or it's rain directly on the soil. And so that can have huge impacts.
And it's kind of interesting, the dichotomy that you're speaking to. I mean, a couple of years ago, the Mississippi River, because of some rain on snow, a pretty heavy snowpack in the upper Midwest, the Mississippi reached its fourth highest peak stream flow on record at Davenport around the Quad Cities in spring of 2024. And we saw that, and I was reaching out to Quad City contacts being like, what's going on? Where's this, you know, where is assistance needed? And they're like, we're good. We got it. And it's because they forecasts for this were coming weeks ahead of time. To your point about time scale, it wasn't a flash flood. The Mississippi doesn't flash flood very often. It's much larger. And they were able to get the preparation. They knew how to deal with it. They knew how to sandbag. Both Davenport and Molina, Rock Island, had been, you know, they had pulled a lot of the critical infrastructure off of the really sensitive areas. So they were ready to go versus, let's say, a Gibson City flood just a couple years ago where, like you said, very little warning. It didn't affect a large area, but
locally.
So it's really something.
Terrible. Yeah. So I think flash floods, and a good analogy is that they are more like an earthquake, a localized earthquake, right? In terms of the full disaster scope of the event, whereas the longer, you know, 2 months long floods and or 3 months, you know, floods are a different kind of beast.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And there is another flooding threat here in Illinois, which folks might not be as familiar with, but ice dams, you were telling us about, can form along the Kankakee River. Sort of who is impacted by that and how can they take precautions?
Yeah, so this is an interesting form because in the winter, we can get floods in the winter. Anna spoke about rain on snow when a big snowpack melts rapidly. We also get frozen soil issues in the winter. So water, I mean, frozen soils are essentially like concrete. They're just gonna, water's run right off of them. So, but what is sort of acts like a flash flood are these ice dam, or some people call them ice jam type of flooding. And they tend to happen in some rivers more than others, especially kind of the bigger, wider, slower flowing rivers like the Kankakee, the Rock River, especially as well that flows from Rockford to Rock Island. And what ends up happening is you get in the middle of winter, big old winter or big old ice formation on the river. And then we get an ephemeral kind of early spring. That's when the Midwesterners come out and take off their sweaters and run around in short sleeves because it's like 40 out. And then that ice begins to melt and starts to break up. And some of those little chunks of ice can start to come together and form what's essentially a dam. And so what that means is even though that there's not a lot of water from precipitation coming in, but that dam does what a dam does. It makes the water begin to rise up, and it can be very, very rapidly to the point where we can be in sunny conditions. And this is what makes these kind of ice dams really insidious is that it's not like a storm is expected. It can be sunny conditions, but all of a sudden we get a flash flood warning because there's been an ice dam and we can get pretty rapid rising. And so the good news is that emergency managers know about these areas because, like I said, not every river is prone to these kinds of things. So they know the Will County Emergency Management knows Kankakee River does this. The Ogle County folks know that the Rock River does this. So it's really more about the kind of planning and preparation. And people who live around there generally know this too. But that being said, if we have folks moving into areas around those rivers who may not be familiar with that, it is an important kind of messaging to them that this is something that does happen. And for folks to be prepared for it and kind of understand what the kind of preceding conditions look like so that they can be ready.
Just want to take a quick moment to say that this is Weather Realness, the show about weather and climate here in Illinois. And we are talking about flooding with Illinois State Climatologist Trent Ford and Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois, Anna Barros. So, Anna, can you talk about some of the after effects of floodings? What are kind of some of the impacts on kind of infrastructure, property, crops, mold, kind of things like that?
So, you know, we really have, again, two different types of events, right? The very, you know, the flash floods in mountainous terrain, usually they come along with mud flows and with debris flows and landslides. Entire hill slopes can come down, right? And so if you go, for example, to the southern Appalachians, you do see that when we have these events, usually there's a whole hillside that came down and a house that was totally, you know, brought down. So that's a different type of system. After Hurricane Helen in Asheville, the entire water distribution system fell apart, right? So they had a flood event 15 or 20 years ago. They had built a whole new water distribution system. But because of landslides and because of these debris flows, it all was kind of excavated and torn apart. So that took months. And so people in Asheville were for 3 months without tap water, right? Without clean water. Now in other areas, it's really just the water, right? If you are, for example, in New Orleans or here, for example, so the water level goes up very fast. It gets into basements. It gets into homes, and so on. Now, depending on the infrastructure, on the foundations, some of the houses actually become very unstable, right? So if they don't have pillars and so on, you know, they could become very unstable. The other implication you mentioned that was that after the flood comes through, right, you have this entire house because of the materials we use that are wood and other types of soft materials. The humidity is really hard to get rid of. And so mold grows, right? And when mold grows, it's basically you have to actually build everything again from scratch, right? So the costs of these events are very high.
And Trent, you kind of mentioned earlier that there's some impact on crops as well that we'll see after these kind of like aerial widespread floods. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, if the flooding or the heavy rainfall falls on an already established planted crop that's far enough along, you know, if we get flooding maybe a week or two after planting, even if the crop's emerged, usually farmers can replant without too many problems. But once that plant is a few weeks along, it's really challenging to do that. So corn, soybeans, most grain plants, and even annual vegetables do not like to have roots submerged for more than a couple days. And oftentimes, if this happens in summer, that standing water in fields of floods will often reach temperatures of 100 or more degrees Fahrenheit. And so you're essentially having cooked plants. So we've seen this before where, you know, we get a really big flash flood event or a really heavy rainfall event in a flat part of Illinois, and there'll be standing water in the middle of a field. So you'll go out a couple months later and there's healthy, vibrant growing corn around an area where there's nothing. And that's where that water stood. So we can see that kind of widespread crop impact. And to Anna's point, I mean, you get the big river floods that not only flood much larger areas, but also stay around for a while, have the capacity to make much larger economic impacts as far as crops are concerned. Also, we tend to see in the flooded areas, even if the water recedes fast enough to save the crop, we'll have issues with disease, just like the mold growth, people's homes, disease on the plants as well, especially fungal disease that thrives really well in wet conditions. So yeah, you know, we think about drought as a big ag killer, but actually there was a paper from the College of Aces not too long ago that showed that flooding, at least in Illinois, and heavy rainfall has caused as much crop damage as drought over the last 20 years. So It's kind of interesting to think of it that way.
Interesting. Appreciate both of your expertise.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was great to be here with Trent.
We've been talking with Anna Barros, professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Illinois, about flooding and climate. If you have a question about Illinois climate and water, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Next week, we're talking about corn sweat and agriculture under the changing climate. Weather Realness is produced by Patricia Bradford, Reginald Hardwick, and me, Maddie Stover. Trent Ford is the Illinois State Climatologist and the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute. Check out this podcast on the Illinois Public Media YouTube channel. Illinois Public Media is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Maddie Stover. We'll talk with you again next week.